I have a favor to ask. Everyone who listens to these podcasts, I am asking that you would subscribe to The Gazette, our new digital magazine. It works on all devices and is guaranteed to give you hours of great entertainment. If you're listening to any of our podcasts, please go to oldtimeradiodvd.com and subscribe. Give it a few issues. If you don't like, simply unsubscribe. But I know that you're going to love The Gazette, oldtimeradiodvd.com to subscribe. You'll be glad you did.
Lucy had a good brain, even though she'd lived all her life in L.A. Despite the continual exposure to carbon monoxide and people from the film industry, she remained smart. She had trained as a lawyer and was well regarded in the firm where she practiced. Her speciality was entertainment law, but she still liked to use that brain of hers, and here was a good opportunity. Now, where would they keep the oxygen equipment? She actually said it aloud as she paced around the loggia at the top of the central well. Got it! Suddenly she knew exactly where to look. God, it was so great to be bright. She'd always thanked her stars that she hadn't been born a busty bimbo like some people she could think of. A department store, she told herself, a department store would have a plan of the store by the elevators, so... And sure enough, there it was, by the elevators, even though this wasn't a department store. She pressed a small button, and a large area of the floor lit up, displaying the plan of the starship Titanic. What's more, she could zoom in and out with a second control. This was better than anything they had at Macy's. Lucy slipped on her translator specs and read, Medical Center. That was where she'd find oxygen. And without waiting to take advantage of any of the special offers the plan of the ship assured second-class passengers they would be delighted with, she made her way to the starship's medical center. The medical center of the starship took up a whole 400-yard section of the main hull, under the embarkation level. It was dazzlingly new and clean, and it said, Hello, and welcome to the medical center of the starship Titanic. A place to enjoy and savor the good things of life while you still have it. Not just somewhere to be sick. We guarantee you will feel no pain once you have placed your credit card in our card care machine. Jesus, thought Lucy, could they do with a new copywriter? Her breathing was all the time becoming a little more difficult, and it was noticeably colder. She looked around for anything that might resemble an oxygen cylinder, and suddenly froze in a way that had nothing to do with the temperature. Unlike the rest of the ship, the medical center was not unpopulated. There were two people, or were they people? There were two figures on the floor, and one of them was looking straight at her. Lucy stared back. Somehow she knew, without a shadow of a doubt, that he was not human. He looked human enough, but there was a curious otherness about him. It was intangible, subtle, intriguing. Then she noticed he had the most beautiful orange eyes. Lucy screamed and turned to escape, but the alien had already leapt to its feet, and the door of the medical center had closed behind her. In her panic, she couldn't figure out how to open it again. A powerful arm gripped her round the neck, and a voice that sent a shiver right through her said, Don't struggle, I can break your neck. Lucy went kind of limp. She always claimed she didn't actually faint, but the journalist, for this is who had his arm around her neck, later said he dragged her over to the nearest bed and laid her out unconscious for several minutes. When Lucy came round, she saw her blood-stained assailant bent over a dead body. She realized immediately he was a crazed killer searching through his victim's clothes. Such odd clothes, Lucy noticed. Strange colors, strange cuts, strange materials. It was at this point that she also realized she was tied down to the bed. The full horror of her situation suddenly hit her, like a 40-ton truck hitting a shop window. She was devastated, and her alarm went off. Screamed Lucy. The journalist looked across at her and clicked his teeth in annoyance. Shut up, he snarled. Oh my God, the murderer had spoken to her! Here she was, a defenseless woman, tied down onto a bed, waiting for this violent sadist to finish rifling the pockets of his last victim, and then come across to her and do what? Do whatever he likes. That's what, to her, to Lucy Webber, a graduate of UCLA Law School. Lucy had never screamed so well or so effectively in her life. Unfortunately, the effect was not to bring Dan running to her rescue, but to attract the unwanted attentions of her murderous assailant. He came across and stared into her eyes. The screams died on her lips as she registered the cruel twist of his mouth, the sadistic glint in those beautiful orange-coloured eyes. The next moment she saw his blood-stained hand move to cover her mouth. "Listen," said the psychopath. "There's a bomb on board this ship. It's going to explode and take us with it, unless I can find it quick, so just shut up with the screaming. I can't think, and it makes me crazy." "God," thought Lucy. "It was just like one of those films, where the heroine is captured by the serial killer rapist, and yet finds herself strangely drawn to him. What am I thinking about?" Lucy suddenly brought herself up short. Screaming really seemed the only sensible alternative. "Didn't you hear what I said?" The killer rapist was now glaring into her eyes once again. Lucy felt her bowels go soft with fear, and her breath grew even scarcer than it was. "There is a bomb. I have to find the bomb." Lucy went quiet and thought about this. A bomb was clearly not good news. The murderer returned to his victim and continued examining his pockets, of which there were rather a lot. Scraliontis had always been an expensive dresser, and he could always reckon on his suits having more pockets than anyone else's, that being the fashion of the day. "Suffering supernovae," thought the journalist. "I've never seen so many pockets." "Why are you doing that?" Lucy surprised herself with the steadiness of her voice. "I'm looking to see if he's got a plan or anything to show where the bomb is," said the journalist. "Why should he have?" asked Lucy. "Stop asking questions," snapped the journalist. I just asked why." "Because he planted the bomb." "Oh," said Lucy, "thank you." And then thought, why on earth am I being polite to someone who's just about to kill me? Maybe even rape me first. Or maybe he isn't. Maybe there were mitigating circumstances. Maybe the psychopath wasn't a psychopath. Maybe he was a caring family man with a flair for initiating excitement, who was resourceful in danger, and yet prepared to submit to the will of a strong and loving woman. Is that why you killed him?" Lucy felt surprisingly childish asking the question.
Because he planted the bomb?"
"I didn't kill him." Suddenly Lucy saw the murderer in a new light. For a start, he wasn't a murderer. In the second place, she noticed he was hurt himself. He seemed to be in some pain as he bent over the body. Perhaps he wasn't going to rape or kill her either. "Ha-ha!" The journalist gave a yell that made Lucy jump.
Have you got it?"
Lucy asked nervously.
"Shut up," said the journalist.
He had a small piece of paper, which he was now stuffing into one of his many pockets, although he didn't have nearly as many as Scraliontis.
Hey, you can't leave me here!"
Lucy had gone from abject terror to incensed indignation, in less time than most people could go from feeling okay to still feeling okay.
"I can't waste time," snapped the journalist. "It may go off any second," and he made for the door. "Don't leave me tied up in here with a dead body!"
screamed Lucy. Something in her tone of voice, maybe the sheer volume of it, made the journalist stop. He turned and looked at Lucy in her power pinstripe, tied to the bed, her black hair falling across her face.
"Shit," he said.
The actual Bleontine phrase was north of Pangolin, which was a particularly unpleasant suburb of Bleontis, the capital of Bleontin, but the meaning was shit. He limped over to the bed and untied Lucy.
"Just don't get in the way," he said. "Don't talk to me like that," fired Lucy. "Oh, you're going to be a great help, I can see that."
And the journalist set off down the corridor towards the stairs up to the embarkation level.
"Wait!" Lucy shouted after him. "I've got to find a supply of oxygen."
"Forget it."
"But it's getting hard to breathe."
"Not as hard as it will be once we're tiny fragments floating in space," retorted the journalist. Lucy was by now running alongside him.
"Hey, you're an alien, aren't you?" she suggested, as they waited for the doorbot to open the door to the second-class area.
"No," replied the journalist. "You're the alien. This is a Bleontinian starship, in case you hadn't noticed."
"Ah, point taken," said Lucy.
Dan would never have talked to her like this.
"Oh, my God!"
The doors opened, and she took in for the first time the majestic sweep of the Grand Axial Canal's second class.
"She plummeted and hit his head, and gave him 6 panades as a tip," sang the gondoliers.
"Oh!" The journalist gasped as he stepped down into the nearest gondola and missed his footing. Lucy caught him and held him for a moment.
"You're hurt," she said.
"Let's get on," he returned. "We've no idea when the bomb is time to go off." Lucy helped him down into the gondola, and the singing stopped. "Take us to the engine room," gasped the journalist, holding his stomach.
"CC, nitrogen-loathing respecters of Prestville!
And make it fast!
CC!"
The gondola set off down the Grand Canal at no greater speed than any other. Lucy looked across at her former assailant. He was rocking backwards and forwards, hugging himself.
"Are you cold?" asked Lucy.
She certainly was. But the journalist didn't reply. He just gritted his teeth, and Lucy suddenly realized he was in real pain.
"What happened?" she asked, and touched his arm. That bastard, Scraliontis, stabbed me with a table lamp," growled the axe murderer.
Lucy stifled a laugh.
"How can you stab someone with a..." "It had a sharp end," interrupted the journalist.
"Are you in pain?" asked Lucy. The journalist grunted. Lucy leaned towards him and moved his hands away from his stomach. The unfamiliar smell of a being from another world caught her unawares. It was not unpleasant, quite the contrary, but it made her head spin.
"Leave me alone," he growled. "Let me look at it."
Lucy pulled him back onto the pillow and tried to open his clothes, where the congealed blood was thickest.
"I have no idea how to undo this," she said. "Thought seal," he said.
And suddenly the garment opened, so that Lucy was able to pull it back and reveal the journalist's gouged flesh.
"Oh, it's nasty," she said. "Look!"
Suddenly she made a quick movement. The journalist yelled, and she pulled a large shard of glass from his abdomen. The blood welled up again from the wound.
I couldn't see it," he gasped. "Thanks."
And he held up a small packet.
"Here," he said.
"Oh, thank you," said Lucy. She accepted the gift in what she felt was an appropriately gracious way.
"What is it?" "A plaster," said the journalist. "Stick it on before I bleed to death." "A lady, she say, we ought to sing while passengers are in the gondola and not other way round,"
confided the gondola bot, clearly feeling the need for a bit of small talk.
"We think something may be seriously wrong." "Just get us to the engine room," gasped the journalist.
By the time they reached the engine room, Lucy had managed to convince the journalist that her name really was Lucy.
"But you know what that means in Blarontin."
The journalist was in some pain from the laughter. He'd managed to stop at last, and Lucy was feeling a bit piqued.
"Now," she said coldly, "what does it mean?"
"I can't tell you," he replied.
"I'd like to know."
No, I just couldn't."
"What's so funny? Go on, you've got to tell me."
Maybe when I know you better. Oh, it hurts."
"Well, what's your name?" she asked.
The journalist," replied the journalist.
"That's not a name, that's a job description."
The journalist shrugged.
"On Blarontin, us news hacks aren't allowed individual names. It's an ancient law, something to do with avoiding the cult of the personality or something."
I can't call you the journalist."
"Just call me the," he said,
and opened the luminous blue doors of the engine room. A quick look inside drew his attention immediately to the small cabinet in the corner. The journalist strode straight across to it, opened the doors, and glanced at the two buttons. Without hesitation, he pressed the one marked "Press to Arm." Immediately a flap opened, and a large black steel egg with fins rose up out of the top of the cabinet. At the same time, a voice boomed out,
"You have just activated the 8D96 full-force megascuttler, a bomb to be proud of, created especially for you by the Megascuttler Corporation of Dormillion. This will be a fairly big explosion, so please stand well back, about 22,000 miles. Countdown to detonation commencing at once. 1,999, 998, 997.
Lucy couldn't believe what she'd just witnessed. She looked at the two buttons again through her translator specs.
"Why, for crying out loud, did you press the button that says press to arm?"
The journalist was hopping round the engine room, kicking himself.
"I didn't know it was a Dormillion bomb. But what difference does it make? A bomb's a bomb. I can't explain.
I need to know, insisted Lucy.
No, you don't.
He was perfectly right. Lucy herself wondered why she was pressing this point. She grabbed hold of the journalist's shoulders and shook him.
Look, you stupid jerk, you've just done something really stupid, and I have a right to know why. All right.
The journalist seemed to be calming down.
It's just that the Dormilion for press to arm is very similar to the Blorontin for please press dog. It was just a simple mistranslation. I was wondering what the dog had to do with it.
Great, said Lucy.
So now we really are up shit creek without a bucket.
993, 992, 991, continued the bomb.
What are we going to do? She yelled.
We're going to keep calm, said the journalist. Good thinking, the, snorted Lucy, calling up her not inconsiderable reserves of sarcasm.
You clearly have a mind the size of Arnold Schwarzenegger's humeral ligament. We're running out of oxygen. The temperature's rapidly becoming suitable for an Arctic winter on Pluto. You've just activated what was otherwise a harmless bomb, and now you have the nerve to tell me to stay calm.
Who's Arnold Schwarzenegger? Asked the journalist.
Ah!
Lucy decided that a good scream was probably the wisest course of action under the circumstances. The journalist suddenly screamed as well. Lucy stopped her screaming and looked at him.
I'm sorry, he said. It's just I can't think when you do that.
Lucy felt stupid.
I'm sorry, too, she said.
The journalist smiled and then, for no apparent reason, gave her a kiss on the cheek. Lucy was so surprised to be kissed by an alien, she simply stood there and heard him say,
The clock is counting once every inim. That gives us about 16 Edos before it gets to zero.
How long's an inim? Lucy wanted to say, but her mouth wasn't working. All she could do was stare into those strange and beautiful eyes as she heard him say,
What we must do is find the lifeboats.
Dan was still deep in argument with the desk lamp in the embarkation lobby. It was an argument that he had become familiar with over the years of Top Ten travel. But there was something wrong. Somehow he just wasn't getting his points across. This damn desk lamp seemed to be coming out on top every time. Then Dan realized the problem was the air, or rather the lack of air. He just wasn't getting the amount of oxygen into his brain that a travel agent really needs in order to argue for a free upgrade. He was panting and gasping. He was also on his knees, and his head was beginning to spin.
Look, if you want me to go to the press and blow this story up, I'm quite happy to do so.
He knew once you were reduced to this line of attack, the cause was probably lost. They'd never get into first class, they'd never get to the captain, and they'd all die of asphyxiation and cold. Great! At that moment, he heard footsteps running across the loggia of the central well, and an exhausted Lucy, accompanied by a strange man with bright orange eyes, staggered into the embarkation lobby. They collapsed next to Dan and lay there trying to get their breath.
Hey, who's this?
Dan was surprisingly indignant for someone who was in the process of dying of asphyxiation.
Bomb!
Gasped the journalist.
You're a bomb? Said Dan.
No!
Lucy felt she had to explain.
This is Dan. Dan, this is the...
Dan blinked a few times.
There's a bomb on board. It's about to go off. The journalist managed to get out.
Well, we've got to get to the lifeboats.
They're in first class, explained Lucy. Naturally.
Now that is outrageous.
Dan took this new ammunition and turned on the deskbot.
If I tell the Travel Association that, they'll blacklist your whole fleet forever.
Wow, that was some threat.
Dan knew they'd had it levelled against the Top Ten Travel Co. Inc. countless times. The deskbot tapped its fingers on the desk and gazed up at the ceiling.
Do you hear? Exclaimed Dan. I'll close this whole goddamn company down.
Listen, you dumb bot!
The journalist had grabbed the deskbot by its scrawny stand.
This is a matter of life and death. There's a bomb about to go off in...
He checked his watch.
In 10 Edos of pangolin!
How long's that? Asked Dan.
But the journalist wasn't listening. He was too busy shaking the robot. Suddenly there was a crack and a flash, and all the lights went off for an instant.
Hey! Cried everyone, and the lights came on again, although there was no cause and effect between the shout of hey and the recommencement of illumination. I'm sorry, there is nothing I can do unless you have a galactic gold credit card.
replied the robot in a simulated strangled voice.
Pangolin, repeated the journalist.
Please mind your language, croaked the despot.
Don't you have a credit card, the... asked Lucy. She was appalled to think her new friend might not be the most solvent character on Bluontin.
Not a galactic gold, he said.
Who is this?
Dan had switched back to indignation mode.
You've got to earn over 7 panadas a week to get one of those beauties.
The journalist was still trying to strangle the desk bot.
Oh, it's getting really hard to breathe, choked Lucy.
Ice was now forming on the edge of the desk. Dan pointed at it.
You call that supergalactic class comfort?
Take your hands off my flex, choked the despot. You'll short me again.
Get us into first class now, choked the journalist,
or I'll smash your lampshade.
Lucy had collapsed on the floor, and Dan rushed to her.
Hey, where'd you find that guy? He whispered into her ear.
Save your breath, panted Lucy.
Ah!
Screamed the deskbot.
Security!
May you rot in pangolin, yelled the journalist.
It was at that moment that an extraordinary thing happened. Or rather, it was at that moment that an extraordinary thing crawled into the embarkation lobby, across the highly polished floor and up to the deskbot. It was clearly alive, although only just. And it was very old, very, very, very old. It was wizened and blackened. In its twig-like fingers, the creature held a personal electronic thingy. It waved this under the deskbot's nose and croaked in an ancient voice,
"Upgrade, all of us!"
The deskbot immediately sprang to attention and became perceptibly brighter.
Of course, madam. What a pleasure to welcome you to the first-class facilities of the starship Titanic. You will find them without equal anywhere in the galaxy. Please go through and have a pleasant trip.
There was a hiss of air returning to the cabins and an instant rise in temperature as the ship registered the arrival of 4 first-class passengers. The door to the first-class area swung open and Dan and Lucy, the journalist and the ancient creature, stepped through into another and even more amazing world.
Nettie, exclaimed Dan. My God, you're Nettie! What's happened to you?
But the ancient creature, who Dan had rightly diagnosed as Nettie, couldn't reply. The moment they had passed into the first-class section, she collapsed and lay as if dead. The Gap T-shirt hung around her shrunken frame like an overlarge pullover. Her jewellery looked foolish and ill-advised on her scrawny wrists and neck. What on earth, or off the earth, had happened to her? What had, in fact, happened was this. The starship Titanic was powered by the latest and most incredible invention of the great Leovinus's genius. No one knew how he had done it, and he had kept it an absolute secret. But somehow he had harnessed for the starship, his beloved masterpiece, the vastest source of power in the probable universe. A captive black hole. Naturally, something as powerful as a black hole needed very careful handling and had to be surrounded by incredible safety precautions. Unfortunately, safety was one thing that neither Scraliontis nor Bobostigan had had first in their minds when they began to reduce the specifications for the construction of the ship.
There won't be anybody in the engine room, explained Scraliontis,
when even Bobostigan had queried the wisdom of reducing the incredibly strong glass company's specs for the observation window into the black hole. Bobostigan had not been reassured.
But you know what black holes are like.
Actually, Scraliontis didn't. He was an accountant and not an engineer. In any case, black hole technology was a brand new concept straight out of Leovinus's brain.
Just take Leovinus's lowest parameter for the glass shield, he snapped. We can't afford any more.
It was Nettie who discovered the problem thus caused by Scraliontis's cost-cutting, as she climbed the ladder, looking for the phone to the captain's bridge. The force of the black hole had simply plucked her off the ladder and absorbed her through the incredibly strong glass company's below-spec window. Once in the black hole, she had begun to spin around for, as far as her body was concerned, hundreds of years, travelling millions of light-years round in tiny circles. Fortunately, she still had her personal electronic thingy on her, and this dutifully clocked up all the miles she travelled. Nettie herself didn't know how she had escaped.
In fact, she had been thrown clear of the black hole when the journalist had short-circuited the deskbot. Betty was, miraculously, still alive, and, even more miraculously, still had the presence of mind to realise that she had accumulated millions of light-years of space miles, enough to get them all free upgrades to first class.
"Less than 8 Edos to go," exclaimed the journalist. "And that's assuming the bomb doesn't speed up its counting."
What can I do about Nettie?"
cried Dan, holding the ancient creature pathetically in his arms.
"Oh, leave her. We've got to find the lifeboats."
And the journalist was off, running along the embankment of the Grand Axial Canal first class, with Lucy in close pursuit.
"Come on, Dan," she called.
"I can't just leave her," Dan yelled back.
But they turned a corner and were gone. Dan tried to lift the ancient Nettie up, but even though she was emaciated and shriveled, he was too exhausted to carry her anywhere.
"I can't leave you," he murmured, and stroked her hair.
And now he looked around and, for the first time, took in the extraordinary vista presented by the Grand Axial Canal First Class. If the word posh ever had any meaning, this was it. It was luxury. It was deluxe. It was expensive. It was also redolent with the operatic singing of the gondola bots.
"He helped to chalk her tightrope walk so that the lovely lady wouldn't slip."
Dan had always hated opera.
"Let's go somewhere quiet," he whispered to Nettie.
And he finally lifted her up and staggered into the nearest doorway. Lucy and the journalist had, meanwhile, discovered that the star-struck Construction Company, Inc. had not skimped on the signs to the lifeboats first class. There were big, reassuring signs almost everywhere you looked. They were illuminated, and some of them incorporated flashing arrows. Consequently, the two arrived at the lifeboat assembly station in less than a minute.
7 Edos to go," gasped the journalist.
As he said this, both he and Lucy discovered that while they hadn't skimped on the signs, the star-struck Construction Company, Inc. had economized on the boats themselves. In fact, they had economized completely and utterly on them.
"Well, what's the point of providing lifeboats?" reasoned Scraliontis to an increasingly nervous Probostigan, "if there aren't going to be any passengers."
"The bastards," groaned the journalist. "We're done for. We'll be blown to little bits of drifting cosmos in exactly 6 Edos, 45 innims."
The journalist sank to his knees. The fight had gone out of him. He looked so helpless, so forlorn. Lucy couldn't help it. The thought of imminent destruction threw all the usual caution out of her mind. She leapt to a conclusion that she would probably not even have begun to recognise under normal conditions.
"Oh, God, I love you!"
And before the journalist realised what was happening, Lucy was all over him, kissing his mouth and running her fingers through his hair.
"Ow, ouch!" the journalist yelled. "Mind my wound!"
I'm sorry," yelled Lucy. "But we've only got 6 Edos left, whatever they are. I've never felt like this for anyone. The moment I set eyes on you, oh, God, no one's ever going to know. Nothing matters anymore, but hurry, do something."
And she was wrestling with his clothing.
"I can't get it off. I told you it's thought-sealed."
His clothes suddenly pinged open, and the next minute Lucy had flung her pinstriped power suit onto the empty lifeboat ramp. Her fingers ran over the alien's body as she got on top of him.
"Oh, God," she cried, feeling the blood draining down into her lower abdomen like a rush of seagulls onto the last herring. "We've probably only got 5 of whatever those things are left. Edos!"
The journalist tried not to yell out with the pain of his wound.
"We've got 5 Edos left. Oh, this is incredible. We don't do it like this on Blorontin."
"Why not?"
Lucy asked, although she didn't really care.
"It's illegal."
The journalist was grinning from ear to ear.
"We're only allowed snork style, you know, upside down and from above."
"Oh, shut up,"
Lucy was kissing him.
"I had to tell you, I had to. I love you, I've always loved you. That's what's been missing. Ah, ah."
"Quick," cried the journalist. They had only 60 innims before the bomb exploded.
"Yes, yes."
They rolled and kissed each other, oblivious to the cold metal floor of the lifeboat ramp under their naked flesh.
"Life is so short."
Lucy suddenly grabbed his hand and looked at his watch. It was totally incomprehensible.
"What's it say? 30 innims. Is that all? Yes, yes, I love you," cried Lucy. "Oh,"
cried the journalist. And the two of them collapsed together as the clock clicked to 0. They lay there waiting for the forever-ending explosion that would terminate their brief affair. But, unlike the two lovers, it didn't come. Lucy was the first to speak.
What's happened?
I don't know, said the journalist. I don't know. At the same moment, Nettie suddenly managed to sit up on the couch on which Dan had placed her.
Oh, my God! There's only 5 minutes before the bomb goes off!
5 minutes, thought Dan. This is where, in a cheap novel, the couple, confronted by imminent oblivion, would suddenly make passionate love. It was a pity Nettie was now as old as she was.
You've got to go and talk to it, she pleaded.
What?
I can't explain, just believe me. It's in the engine room. Hurry!
What? Repeated Dan, a bit gormlessly.
Hurry! The engine room, speak to the bomb!
Dan decided that, while gormlessness had its place in the human repertoire of reactions, now was neither the time nor place for it. He sprinted out of the beauty salon, which was apparently where they were, and ran down the length of the Grand Axial Canal, trying to ignore the inevitable chorus.
She threw her arms around his charms and gave him 6 panades as a tip.
The first thing Dan saw when he burst into the engine room was a large bomb sticking up out of a cabinet. A friendly sort of voice was booming out.
58, 57, 56, 55, 54.
Dan couldn't think what to say. After all, he'd never addressed a bomb before. He didn't have a clue what sort of thing it would be interested in.
Hello, he said. 53, 52, hello, 51, 50, replied the bomb genially. any chance of you not exploding?
Dan thought he might as well get straight to the point.
No, 48, 47.
Dan was not the most imaginative of men. He knew it, Lucy knew it. Nigel had known it. He was dedicated, hard-working, loyal, thorough, all those admirable and desirable things for anybody's partner to be. But leaps of the imagination were not his forte, and yet he had one now. He suddenly knew the one thing that bombs were bound to be interested in.
Look, do you really want to do this? He asked. I mean, isn't it a bit self-destructive?
46, 45, 40. Look, I'm just a simple counting and exploding device, and I'm not equipped for philosophical discourse. Please do not speak to me while I'm counting. Damn, now you've made me lose my place, you see? Recommencing countdown.
1,999. 998. Got the sucker, thought Dan.
He checked his watch against the bomb's counting. They had about 16 minutes before they needed to talk to it again. He turned and raced back to Nettie. As he ran, the thought of Nettie kept riffling his mind like a gambler's hands riffling a deck of cards. God, she was so intelligent. How had she found out about the bomb's weakness so quickly? The clarity of her intellect made him feel so ordinary and humble. But then he suddenly remembered how she seemed old and shriveled. He must have been seeing things. That couldn't have happened to the beautiful, gorgeous Nettie. And yet, it was then that Dan found himself thinking the most curious thought. Of course, it was terrible if something had happened to Nettie, and what had happened to her. But at least now, thought Dan, he might stand a chance of winning her. Lucy was putting her clothes on rather hurriedly. The fact that she and the journalist had not been blown to cosmic dust had severely embarrassed her. In fact, she didn't know where to look. The journalist was regarding her curiously.
"You do things very differently in your world," he said.
"Oh?" Lucy tried to pretend that everything was perfectly normal.
"Yes," he said. "On Blorontin we have all these absurd rituals we have to go through before having sex. There's a thing called dating, when a young couple go out for evenings together without necessarily going the whole way, as we say. Then there's a thing called the engagement, where rings are exchanged. And finally, there's an elaborate ceremony called a wedding, with a cake and bridesmaids and the best man's speech, not to mention the honeymoon. Oh, you wouldn't believe the rigmarole we have to go through in order to make love to each other. I like your Earth way of doing it much better."
The bomb might still go off any second, Lucy reminded him.
The bomb? Oh, pangolin, I'd forgotten.
The journalist thought-sealed his clothes. As they raced down the Grand Axial Canal second class, they didn't realise that they had missed bumping into Dan on his way back to the beauty salon by exactly a 1/864th of a second, which, by an incredible coincidence, was exactly where the bomb had got to in its countdown when Lucy and the journalist arrived back in the engine room.
864! 863! Said the bomb.
Why has it only got as far as 863? Wondered Lucy.
You're beautiful, replied the journalist. Lucy became aware that he was still looking at her in a rather odd way, and she suddenly wished he'd concentrate on the problem in hand.
Maybe it doesn't count when we're out of the room, she suggested.
She pulled her companion out of the door, but as she started to listen, Lucy suddenly felt the alien's hands around her breasts.
"Whoa, Lucy, I can't stop thinking about you," he murmured as he nuzzled her neck.
862, 861, continued the bomb.
That was one theory out of the way, thought Lucy, disentangling herself from the journalist's embrace. Back in the room, she stared at the bomb and tried to think. But it was hard with the alien sticking his tongue in her ear and saying he loved her more than anything on his world.
"Please, the," exclaimed Lucy. "Well, we haven't got time for that now."
"Oh, you started it," he reminded her. "Once we're roused, us Blerontinian males tend to be very single-minded."
"I've met your type before," said Lucy, trying to push him away.
"Oh, just put your hands on my thing again,"
he was whispering in her ear.
"Stop it," cried Lucy.
What, replied the bomb. "Oh, damn, I thought you were talking to me. Now you've made me lose count. Recommencing countdown. 1,999.
"Oh, I love you," said the journalist. "You're all I've ever dreamed about."
"That's it," exclaimed Lucy. "We've got to keep talking to the bomb."
"Please put your hand here," said the journalist.
"Listen," cried Lucy to the bomb. "Which baseball team won the World Series in 1997?
997. Oh, now I've told you before about interrupting me while I'm in the middle of a countdown. If you want a bomb you can have a good natter with, we should have got the Mega Scuttler Pro, which has multitasking, speech recognition and general chattering software, and therefore makes an altogether more expensive bang. As it is, you've got me, and I'm doing my best under increasingly trying circumstances. Recommencing countdown. 1,999.
"You have the most wonderful skin," moaned the journalist, biting Lucy quite hard on the earlobe.
"Ouch," cried Lucy. "Look, sir, you've got to stay here and keep talking to the bomb while I go up and find the captain's bridge."
"I can't bear to be separated from you."
"If you don't stay and talk to the bomb, we're both going to get blown up," she replied.
"Oh, just bring me off once more," pleaded the journalist. "I'll be able to think properly then, honestly. Blerontinian males need to have 2 orgasms before they can think straight. It's well known."
Lucy sighed, brushed the alien's hair straight, and wondered what on earth she'd got herself into. While Dan had gone to talk to the bomb, the prematurely aged Nettie had taken the opportunity to look around the room in which she found herself. At first, she thought it must be some sort of torture chamber, or at least an interrogation room. But once she'd put on her translator specs, she realised she was in the ship's hairdressing and beauty parlour. The thumb screws were actually elaborate nail clippers, the electric chairs were highly ergonomic sitting structures, and the individual gas chambers were hairdryers. It was obvious once you read the motto over the doorway.
"Welcome to the Starship Titanic Beauty Therapy and Hair Creationary. You will leave here lovelier and younger."
Nettie put out a wizened finger and pressed the button on the wall beside the couch, which was marked Press for Service. A metal cage on an articulated arm suddenly sprang up over the back of the couch and dangled a few inches in front of her face. At the same time, a large glass case began to descend from the ceiling until both she and the couch were encompassed by it. A reassuring voice then said, "We have assessed your beauty requirements, and whilst recognising you have a severe problem, we would like to reassure you that there is little that you can wish to be done that we cannot accomplish, thanks to the de-aging and re-beautifying techniques pioneered by Dr. Leovinus in this machine. So lie back and relax whilst we return you to the bloom of youth. Normally our therapy would require a few minutes, but in cases such as yours, a little longer may be necessary. We apologize for the delay." The next moment, the cage fixed itself over her face, and the glass case filled instantly with some purple gas. Nettie was terrified for a second, but then relaxed as the perfumes began to enter her nostrils. Erotic perfumes, exotic perfumes, scents she had never imagined, scents of far away and wonder. At the same time, the feeling on her face was inexpressibly soft and kindly. She lay back and just hoped that Dan had managed to talk to the bomb. Dan hurried back from the engine room to find that Nettie had disappeared. Where he'd left her was a glass case filled with purple gas.
"Nettie!" he cried, banging his fists on the glass, but with no effect.
He looked all round the thing, but was unable to find any off switch or any way he could prise the thing off her, if indeed Nettie was in there. After nearly 15 minutes of futile effort, he suddenly remembered he'd need to speak to the bomb again, so he rushed back to the engine room as fast as he could. Meanwhile, the journalist was still trying to put his hand back up Lucy's pinstripe power suit skirt.
"You see, we're just not used to casual sex," he was assuring her. "Blarentinian women make such a fuss about it. You know, they want presents and they want to be treated nice and taken out to expensive restaurants and all that sort of crap. To meet a woman like you is just great. Let's do it again."
"You said twice and you can think straight," objected Lucy, whose mind was focusing on what seemed to her more pressing problems.
"Yeah, but a hand job doesn't really count. Anyway, us Blarentinian males will say anything when we're aroused."
63. 62. 61, said the bomb.
"Hey, bomb, just what do you think you're doing?"
Lucy suddenly remembered what she was meant to be doing.
"Pardon? 60, said the bomb.
"I said, bomb, what the hell do you think you're doing?"
"Oh, don't talk to me, don't talk to me. This is a tricky bit. 59, 8, damn, there I go again, losing concentration. It's all your fault. Recommencing countdown. 1,000.
"And I'm aroused now," said the journalist.
It was at that moment that Dan burst into the engine room. He found the alien, whom he'd already taken an agreeably violent dislike to, kneeling behind Lucy, apparently rubbing himself up against her back. Lucy shot to her feet.
"Oh, Dan, thank God you didn't get blown up."
996, said the bomb. Am I interrupting something?"
Lucy could tell Dan was not in one of his good moods.
And oh, we've just discovered how to confuse the bomb."
"Talk to it," said Dan. "Yeah, Nettie found that out."
"Oh, no, of course, she would."
994, continued the bomb.
"Earth sexuality seems to be very different from Blarentinian," observed the journalist.
"Is it really?"
Dan was sizing the alien up, trying to decide which bit to punch first.
"Yes," said the journalist, putting his arms round Lucy's waist. "On Blarentin, males get what we call jealous. If one male finds another male fondling his girlfriend, he can even become extremely violent."
"Well, it takes all sorts," murmured Dan.
He had already decided on the alien's nose as the first point of contact. But before he could swing his powerful right nose jab, Lucy had managed to disengage herself from the amorous The Journalist and had run over to Dan.
"We got to get off this spaceship as soon as possible. I suggest The here stays and talks to the bomb while we go and find the captain."
"But you don't understand," began the journalist. Dan decided to hold back his fist of retribution for the moment. He would save it for another time.
"I understand only too well. If we don't get the captain to get us back to Earth soon, we'll never get back."
And he was off out of the engine room and racing back down the Grand Axial Canal towards the front of the ship.
"Look, it was great making love with you," Lucy said to the journalist, who was now standing behind her and attempting to fondle her breasts again. "But we've got to get back to the real world, our real world."
And she tried to remove his hands from her blouse.
"But Blarentinian males can't just turn off like that," explained the journalist. "We need multiple satisfactions before we can return to a state of equilibrium."
Lucy had attended self-defense classes for 2 years, when she had just qualified for the law, and had always slightly regretted the fact that she'd never had the chance to put her skills into practice. Consequently, it was with some satisfaction that she suddenly realized this was such an opportunity. She decided to use the standard response to the amorous alien fondling you from behind assault. It was textbook stuff. She drove her right elbow hard into his stomach. "Oomph!" gasped the journalist. Then she swizzled half round, caught his left wrist, and threw him over her shoulder onto the engine room floor. "Oomph!" grunted the journalist. Lucy spoke to him firmly in her best lawyer speak.
"Now you stay here and keep talking to that bomb while I go and find the captain."
Then she was off out of the door, racing after Dan. "You don't understand," the journalist called after her. "There isn't any captain on this ship." But Lucy had gone.
970, said the bomb.
"You don't know what you're doing," yelled the journalist. "You're going to need me."
"Pardon," replied the bomb.
"I wasn't talking to you."
"Oh, damn," said the bomb. "Recommencing countdown. 1,999.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.